Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Dagena Dor, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Professor Fabio Rambelli, who is the editor of the new edited volume, Spirits and Animism in Contemporary Japan, published by Bloomsbury Academic Publishing in 2009. Professor Rambelli, welcome to the show.
Hello, Dagena. It's good Great. To be here.
Thank you. Professor, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself. So how did you become interested in East Asian studies and specifically in Japan?
Oh, that is a long story, and it happened many years ago. I was living in Europe at the time, and I thought I wanted to have a chance to explore other places, and Japan sounded like a good option. It really started like that. And then I went to college and took at the University of Venice in Italy, and I took Japanese studies as my major. It was like a big decision at the time. And I got really fascinated by all these different aspects of Japanese culture, and especially religion and, you know, the philosophies, the ways of thinking, the intellectual history of Japan. And that's how it started.
Oh, wow. Thank you for sharing that with us. So maybe tell us something about the collaboration in the edit volume, Spirits and Animism in Contemporary Japan. So how did it start?
Oh, it's a kind of, in many ways, it's a fortuitous story because, let me backtrack for a moment. I've always been interested in this issue of animism and the spirits because whenever you go to Japan, I mean, they're everywhere. They are in the media, on TV. Of course, they're part of religiosity. They're part of some aspects of public discourse. Japanese identity is defined also in terms of animism. So it's always been something, you know, on the back of my mind. I normally work on pre-modern religion and philosophies, right? But again, this is something that is contemporary, is part of Japan today. And they claim, not only in Japan, but also elsewhere, you know, that it's something that is deeply traditional, you know, dates back from the past. So it was a big question mark for me, you know, this, where does this thing come from? Because again, working on pre-modern religiosities, you don't really see animism described as it is today. So I really don't see the connection between traditional practices and beliefs and what is being done today. They also don't have a term for animism in pre-modern Japan. I mean, that is, you know, they imported the English word for that. So this is, you know, the background information. Then in 2017, here at the University of California, Santa Barbara, you know, we happen to have like four scholars of Japanese religions and intellectual history. In addition to myself, there was Karina Roth from Geneva. There was Andrea Castiglioni, who's now in Nagoya. There was Ellen Van Houten from Kyushu University. So I thought, you know, this is a nice way. You know, we already have four people. We can just invite a few other people and we do something on different aspects of the culture of spirits. And so we had a small conference, which I think was very successful. It was very interesting. It was a very nice vibe among the participants, and then I decided to, you know, to put the papers together into an edited volume. I asked a couple of other people who could not make it to the conference to contribute their own chapters, and that's how the book started. So I think that the originality of this particular the conference first and the book in particular is that it's not only scholars of religion. Precisely because the discourse of animism in contemporary Japan is not a religious discourse per se. Of course, you have new religions doing that. You have some traditional religions also using, you know, interactions with spirits. as one of their forms of, you know, interacting with the sacred. But the idea of, you know, spirits and animism are really part of popular culture. You find them in anime, you find them in literature, you find them in the new artistic expressions and so forth. So in the conference and the book, I decided to also involve either artists or people who are studying artistic expressions like architecture, for example, or new media or literature, right? And then see how ideas of animism are actually embodied in those particular art forms. So in a way, it is a very multidisciplinary project.
Yeah, from looking at the chapters, it seems like it's a very diverse and vibrant collection of contributors. So let's talk about the book. It seems, you know, from the introduction that spirits are everywhere in Japan, right? From the Yasukuni Shrine to anime or popular culture and literature. And you also introduced the term invisible empire. So can you tell us a little bit about what these spirits exactly are and how have scholars tried to explain these presences?
You see, that was the most difficult part of the book, and that's why we have so many collaborators working on very different aspects, because an interesting thing that we realized when we were working on this is that people talk about spirits and animism as if these were simple and easily understandable concepts. You know, animism, everybody knows what it means. And in fact, that's not true. I mean, there are different types of animism, different set of beliefs that are kind of subsumed under this large and vague notion. And the same is true for spirits. There are different types of spirits. And so that was one of the main difficulty. I mean, how can we talk about these terms without really explode them and render them basically useless? And so this was the main challenge. Well, the term invisible empire, you see, I was referring to the empire of science by Roland Barthes. Because the main, the famous book, you know, by the semiotician Roland Barthes, who wrote about Japan, and the main idea behind the Barthes book is that Japanese culture is characterized by the empty center. This is what he calls it, you know. So it's basically, according to Barthes, in Japan there are only signifiers. There is no central, no solid signified. You know, there is no master signified. And to me, that was interesting because, again, the spirits, too, are this kind of ectoplasmic entities that may or may not exist or may not affect the visible and the material, right? But so in a way, they're kind of nice representations in a way, right, of this empty center that Barthes describes. This is not what he means at all, right? But, you know, you can force his description a little bit and get that. Also, the idea of an empire, I mean, it's a kind of a complex organization. So, of course, you know, there are different types of spirits who play different roles in it. Then, after I came up with this term, I checked for some reason on Google, and I found out that it's related to all kinds of conspiracy theories in the United States. And so I didn't even want to mention that because I didn't want to be quoted, you know, in those you know, links. But so I guess it can mean different things in different places, I suppose. But that's what spirits are about anyways.
It's certainly a really interesting term. And you also kind of mentioned that it could also be seen as a sophisticated exercise in what you would call a passionate Orientalism, or perhaps a reverse Orientalism, yeah. Which is the, I quote you here, the acceptance in a Western context of Orientalist theme developed in the East. Can you maybe elaborate on that a little bit?
It may sound a bit confusing, but the history of the interactions between Japan and several Western countries, you know, has always been characterized by the resonance, the mutual resonance of stereotypes and misunderstandings about each other. So Westerners went to Japan and they had their own orientalistic ideas about Japan, right? Then the Japanese absorbed them as they were kind of objective representations and adopt adapted and adopted them to themselves. And then they came up with Occidentalism, you know, like Japanese understanding of the West based on the Western understanding of the East. And so this is one aspect of it. The other aspect is that, and to me, I think it is crucial when we study Japan in particular, is that Orientalism, especially as it applies to Japan, is never kind of a monolithic and kind of oppressive discourse that kind of diminishes and basically offends the other. A lot of descriptions about Japan are really characterized by the quest for the other, by a fascination with something that is supposedly different. Maybe the problem there is that they overemphasize the different, you know, the difference of Japan. But the idea is that Japan is a kind of utopia. Japan is a kind of a extremely desirable and beautiful and amazing place. So that is the kind of positive Orientalism that encourages actually a deeper study and a deeper understanding. So I think that the discourse of animism plays an important role in that, because both the Japanese and the non-Japanese who are interested in that tend to see animism today as a positive thing. Maybe 100 years ago, that was negative, right? That was an aspect of paganism, of superstition, and things like that, and they needed to be eliminated. But today, animism is normally seen in positive terms, you know, as like a deeper understanding of reality, or a love and appreciation for nature, which is lost in other countries, especially in the West. I'm not saying that is true, but I'm saying that is the beginning, you know, it's the starting point of a deeper appreciation of a different culture with different relations with the invisible. And to me, that is an interesting aspect that I think the book also addresses.
All right. Thank you for clearing that up. And, you know, Japan, it's surprising that in a country like Japan, known as for its high degree of secularization, technological advancement, and social developments, ontological assumptions about spirits can be so deeply ingrained in the cultural fabric, in popular culture and everywhere. So how is this seeming paradox reconciled in Japan, if it is indeed seen as a paradox?
Huh. See, that is interesting, because I don't think that in Japan, most people or many people, I mean, this is hard to quantify, right? But from the public discourse, from what you see going on, not many people see this as a contradiction, that technological advances can be reconciled, or at least they're not in contradiction with this kind of care for a supposedly invisible dimension of reality. And so you have even authors theorizing, you know, the fact that machines and computers and objects have a potential type of soul and spirit. And maybe we can talk a little more about that later, but I see in many ways attempts to reconcile these two different aspects, you know, the technological and the pre or non-technological, the very modern and futuristic, perhaps, and something that is considered to be traditional from the past. So maybe it may look like a contradiction to us, but in Japan, that is not seen as a contradiction. But I think it's also because, again, animism and this kind of spirit entities are not clearly defined. So that kind of helps, you know, avoiding conflicts of interpretation.
I see. And this is an important point. Let's just dwell on this a little bit. In the introduction, you also said that modernization in Japan may have reduced the interest of many Japanese for specific Buddhas and kamis, but massive state propaganda in favor of ancestor worship, emperor worship, and the cult of past heroes and the war dead actually promoted a widespread idea that the dead continue to exist in some kind of form in this world. This is a really interesting phenomenon, sort of combining modernization on one hand, you know, inspired by Western sciences and developments, but also this promoted worship of the invisible Can you speak about this a little bit?
You see, the importance of the ancestors, well, the ancestors have always been important in Japan. Well, no, I shouldn't say so, in fact. I mean, we have a chapter by, the first chapter in the book by Sato Hiro makes it clear that ancestors were not really important until maybe the Edo period, or maybe the 15th century, for most people, you know, aristocratic families, some, you know, leading clans and so forth. Of course, they had some type of ancestor cult. But the role of the ancestors becomes really important only in the Edo period for a number of reasons. So this is something that needs to be emphasized. And the idea, see, the importance of the ancestors means that, okay, to me, I think that this is probably the central aspect of the ancestors' worship, is the fact that by worshiping the ancestors, literally, the ancestors are still present in this life. They're not dead, and they continue to influence what is going on in the present. So that establishes a very strong continuity between the past and the present. And the idea is that the present and the future can be contained and oriented, right, based on models and precedents set up in the past. This is the, you know, the typical idea of traditional societies. Whether that was actually the case or not, I mean, of course, it's debatable because, you know, we see a lot of social and cultural change, even in traditional societies, and especially in Japan in the early modern period. But the idea is that the dead are pretty much present and they are able to orient and direct the present and the future. So when it comes to state propaganda, of course, we have the past emperors, we have past heroes, and those all become models for action now and again in the future. So you have this overwhelming presence of the past, which is no longer visible, but is made very solid, right? So I think that this is an aspect, you know, the fact that these, you know, the dead and the invisible, maybe not all of them, but only some of them are important. And they need to be dealt with. On a different level, you also see, so how to deal with your own family ancestors, you know, that becomes a problem, right? Because if they're not state heroes, so I think there was a potential conflict there. And Yasukuni Shrine may have been a way to kind of, because so many people died in war, right? As part of the military or in relation to that. So that could have been a way to include a lot of regular dead into this kind of official sanctioned state pantheon of spirits and heroes. But I think one of the arguments that I put forth in the book is that contemporary interest for spirits and animism is really different from this kind of state cult of heroes and ancestors. So maybe we can talk a bit more about that later, if you're interested in it.
Oh, great! Definitely. We have a few questions that address this issue, and just to maybe dwell on the term spirits and animism. So in the volume, you also warned about the risk of collapsing and confusing or conflating these two categories of spirits and animistic worship of nature. So, for example, the dead of, let's say, war heroes. Are these considered spirits? And if so, then what does animistic worship of nature or animism entail in the context of Japanese spirituality?
Yeah, I think this is one of the central problems when we study Japanese religious and Shinto in particular, because their idea of divinity, of kami, very often intersects with the idea of spirit, which is tama. Or tamashi, and each of these two categories, especially kami, they are incredibly broad categories that cover all kinds of phenomena. So, for example, you have kami that are mountains. So the mountain itself is a kami. It's not that the mountain is the abode of the kami. The mountain itself is a kami, or the waterfall itself is a kami. So this is one thing, and then you have trees. Or buildings, you know, shrines that are temporary abodes of kami. So the kami go there, stay there, and whenever they want, they leave. So these two, I think, the kami as a mountain or the mountain as a kami is one type of god that is different from a flying invisible god that sticks to a tree. So ontologically, I think these are, and phenomenologically, these are very different entities. And then you have the kami as described in the ancient myths. Those are different things. Again, those are not mountains. I mean, those are kind of humanoid or anthropomorphic beings described in the mythology. And then you have people, historical individuals who have been deified for, you know, a whole number of reasons. But again, these deified beings are not the same as the kami as described in the ancient mythology. So again, we have another different category of kami here. And then you have regular people now who are deified simply by performing a Shinto funeral. You know, they're given the title Mikoto, the posthumous title Mikoto. So in name, they are exactly the same as the ancient kami in the mythology, but in fact, they are different. Nobody would ever confuse, you know, Susanoo or Amaterasu with my grandfather. So we have so many different types of kami. Some of them are invisible. Some of them are formerly visible because they were human beings and are no longer visible because now they're kind of more spiritual entities. And then you have visible kami, like rocks or mountains, and they're visible because they're there, right? So this is very confusing. You cannot say the Mount Miwa is a spiritual entity because it's a mountain. And so I'm not even sure, for example, that worshipping a mountain as a kami is a form of animism, because you're not worshipping any specific soul in that mountain. You're worshipping the mountain as a kami, as a whole, right? So to me, that's closer perhaps to like these, you know, older and very complicated and, you know, to deal with a concept of fetishism, you know, in the original term, not in terms of, you know, sexual fetishism, but in the fact that objects or entities, material entities, have an agency in themselves. There is no split between, you know, the invisible spirit and the material, how can we put it, the material box, container, right, that contains the spirit. So that's why I think that a concept of animism is not really enough to describe what goes on in terms of the agency of invisible entities on the one hand and the agency of visible and material entities on the other. And those two agencies, which can be articulated in you know, more complex ways, but these two agencies are normally conflated into what I think is a simplistic vision of animism and spirits.
Oh, thank you for clearing this up, because yes, these two terms in certain, you know, contexts seem to be conflated. And certainly in popular culture about or on Japan and the spirits of Japan. So speaking of animism in Japan, you covered briefly the history of animism, and you also led us to the development of what is called the Japanese neo-animism. So you argue that the accounts of animism written by Japanese intellectuals such as Iwata Kenji were attempts at creating a different description of Japanese spirituality in ways that were unrelated to wartime state Shinto and its authoritarianism, and they tried to reframe Shinto in a broader context that also includes, you know, Taoism and Southeast Asian folk traditions. So what does this reframing project entail? What are they trying to do here?
If you look at the like state propaganda, for example, or state Shinto, like we said before, their focus was on the worship of the emperor, heroes, and family ancestors, you know, because the family was considered as one of the main components of society, right? They didn't really pay a lot of attention, at least as state Shinto, right? They didn't pay attention to the spirits of the trees or the spirits of the forest. Because again, that would take away, you know, like worship from the emperor to other directions that were irrelevant for the state at the time. And I think I can really trace it to the 70s. I haven't found much before that. And the 70s, you have Iwata Kenji, as you mentioned, who becomes the leading intellectual in Japan who proposes this kind of new interpretation of kami as spirits in a very different and more encompassing way. And if you read these books and books written by others, you know, after him, it's really clear that, you know, they're no longer interested, of course, you know, with the emperor, with heroes and so forth. They are really interested in developing like a cosmic spiritual vision in which nature becomes the locus of the sacred and the divine. And the nature is envisioned as full with spiritual powers and agencies. And this is where the concept of animism comes in. It is Iwata and other authors who are actually quoting, you know, the early European anthropologists or ethnographers, right, who were introducing, you know, Tyler, for example, who were introducing the concept of animism. So they use, they appropriate that old and obsolete concept of animism at the time, because no anthropologist would ever quote Tyler positively, right, today. But in Japan, that is seen as a positive Tyler and others, you know, Durkheim and, you know, the Golden Bow, you know, all of these classical, historical, anthropological books are treated as good examples of ways to address animism. So the Japanese adopt them and they try to formulate an alternative vision of the sacred in which the spirits belonging to things and natural entities and sometimes even people are part of the world in itself. And it was striking to me to see that a lot of the intellectuals who write about animism in the 70s, the 80s, all the way until today, they begin as kind of left-wing authors who are trying to go beyond the insularity of Japan and the nationalism of their religious, of Japanese religious discourse. They go beyond it to Southeast Asia, to other parts of Asia. They establish these connections with the past. And that's a way for them to overcome the limitations of past state Shinto and create a more, what they envision as a more peaceful and kind of international or transnational, and at least not nationalistic, vision of the sacred. Personally, I think that this is kind of a self-defeating attempt, because again, by the fact that you emphasize the uniqueness of Japan in grasping that spirituality and keeping that, you know, this kind of animistic outlook, of course, you're emphasizing, I mean, you are creating a different type of a nationalist discourse about Japan. But still, the originality is there, you know, that these authors want to create a different idea of spirituality that is no longer constrictive and reactionary like it was in the recent past. And they use these very archaic concepts, right, such as, you know, spirits and animism in particular.
Oh, very interesting. And these kinds of new framing, would you say that they're also part of a developing discourse known as Nihonjinron or Nihon Bunkakuron? So these ideas that gave to early 20th century Japanese exceptionalism, especially when they reframe animism with regard to Taoism in other parts of Asia and South Asian folk traditions?
Yeah, I think there is a component of, like you said, of Nihonjinron or Nihonbunkaron. And I think it's up to the different authors, you know, to emphasize that aspect or not. But that is certainly part of it. And again, Nihonjinron, I think originally it starts in the, well, again, it has a longer history. But when it comes up in the 70s and 80s, there already are two tendencies there. One is, again, to recuperate, you know, like pre-World War II nationalistic ideas about Japanese uniqueness and reframe them in a non, let's say, controversial or maybe non-religious, non-state Shinto way. So this will be the kind of a right-wing interpretation of Japanese exceptionalism. But you also have another component in which Japanese culture is described as unique because of its peaceful nature, because of its openness to the outside, because of its interest for nature. So they're trying to use part of the the most up-to-date public discourses of the 70s and the 80s, so like world peace, love of nature, environmental concern, and so forth, they're using it to try to describe what they think Japanese essence should be, right? So they're trying to take away, it's a paradoxical attempt, right, to create a sense of national identity which goes beyond nationalism and this kind of world encompassing or like kind of more cosmic in that sense. But like I said, I think that those two tendencies, one is which is kind of internationalist and left-wing and environmental conscious and so forth, ultimately joins with the more right-wing perspective that is centered on the Japanese, on a certain vision of Japanese uniqueness. And you find that, for example, in the public statements of the Japanese Association for Shinto Shrines, you know, the Jinja Honcho, which has fully accepted, you know, this kind of environmental concern for Japanese Shinto. And at that point, it's very hard to make, you know, distinction between, you know, the progressive left-wing intellectuals who proposed that discourse and these more conservative forces that are also using it.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. Indeed, right? It seems from the edited volume that animism in Japan can be either very conservative or progressive, like discussed in many chapters of the book, that it can also be used even to offer a consolatory antidote to personal and social issues, for example, in contemporary art.
Yeah, that is true. So that's also, I think, part of the productivity of the idea of, you know, animism or concept of spirits, because, like you said, you know, they play different functions, different roles for different people in different social contexts. So in terms of art, for example, it can be consolatory, but it can also be a way to explore different types of representations that, you know, have not been tried before. But also in terms of like spiritual beliefs, I can understand why the idea that the dead are present and, you know, it's possible to interact with them even after, you know, they're no longer visible in physical form. I mean, I can see how that can be a type of consolation, right? If you have a good relationship with them, of course, you know, if death happens in a way that is not, I mean, there is no closure, or it ends in, you know, a death that was too sudden and creates a lot of grief and so forth, then it can be more problematic, because the fact that the dead are still there, you know, causes all kinds of anxiety, right? But in many cases, when death is just, you know, sad but normal occurrence, and it's not really a total break, that I think can provide consolation for those who believe that, right? Rather than the idea that the dead go to a distant paradise and, you know, they cannot be reached anymore until the end of times, or something like that. You know, the fact that the formerly living people are still with us in some form, and they look upon us and they help us and we can talk to them, That can be inspiring, I think, you know, to some people.
Yeah, certainly. And from, you know, the vibrant and diverse discussions contained in the various chapters of this book, it's evident now that Japanese animism is anything but a single homogenous discourse. And it's, on the other hand, very, very diverse. So what stands out is also precisely this absence of a unified ontology about spirits and their agency, as argued in the book. However, some modern Japanese intellectuals, such as Minatoka Kumagusu, an author that you have discussed in detail in Chapter 3, developed sophisticated ontologies for the invisible and its denizens. Can you tell us about how he formed his ontologies of the invisible empire and maybe their impact on contemporary Japanese beliefs and practices?
Oh, yeah. Minakata Kumagusu is an incredibly interesting figure, and it's too bad that it's not studied much in the West. We don't have any books written. You know, we have a few chapters here and there, but no books about his work. He's an incredibly interesting intellectual. He's a polymath. I mean, he's really a descendant of the scholars of the late Edo period, you know, who were conversant in many different disciplines. I mean, in Minakata, when he was a kid, he copied the Wakan Sansai Zue, which is the most popular encyclopedia of East Asian knowledge of the Edo period. So he was copying it, you know, the copies that he made by hand, of course, you know, are still, you know, existing. So he learned, you know, he had all these extremely broad and interesting interdisciplinary education. And then he began to absorb, study Western science. And not only, an expert on slime molds, you know, like fungi, like mushroom, but molds in particular, right? Which was kind of a developing field at the time. And he becomes one of the leading international scholars on it. He writes in English and he publishes in respected journals his findings, his discovering about molds. But he is also interested in folklore. He's interested in the history of thought. He's interested in Buddhism, doctrines of Buddhism, and all these kind of things. So it's not just a scientist, and it's not just a humanist. It's really a very interesting combination of the two. And I don't think that he has, you know, going back to the final part of your question, I don't think that he has an impact on contemporary Japanese beliefs as such. But Minakata, since the 1980s, has been rediscovered in Japan, and now is kind of a popular figure because there are several books written by very famous people on his figure. So a certain interpretation of Minakata as an exceptional, you know, kind of a Japanese superhero is still part of the cultural imagination. So I hope that, you know, his breath and of knowledge and his interdisciplinary outlook would inspire, you know, some people from now on. But to go back to the originality of Minakata's thought, so his attraction for slime molds, which, you know, most of us would just think as disgusting things, right? comes from the fact, I mean, he writes it, he says that, you know, the slime molds are not vegetal only, and they're not animal. They're kind of an intermediary liminal stage of life. And he sees in this kind of liminal stage of life all kinds of possibilities. And he also says that, you know, with slime molds, we can study the development of life. We can study all kinds of things that we cannot study with human beings, for example, right? Because we cannot make experiments on them. Whereas slime molds, are kind of a microcosm of what of a number of processes that happen in nature. For example, Minakata emphasizing how a slime mold, for example, grows, becomes something else, comes in a completely different formations, and then they die. But out of their death, a new slime molds are created, and the process is repeated, you know, eternally. And so this process, you know, one being becomes another one, and then it dies, and then it becomes another one, and then another one, and then it dies, and so forth. For him, it's really more than a metaphor. It's really kind of a direct representation of how life and death happen in reality. And then the next step is that Minakata uses this intuition, this understanding of the slime mold, in relation to the mandala of Shingon Buddhism. And he sees the two as two basically the same thing. The mandala itself, you know, is a representations of this continuous creation, transformation, destruction, creation, transformation, destruction that takes place in life. And so some of it is visible, some of it is invisible, and Minakata tries to make sense of all of this, basically. So this is, I think, the fascinating aspect of Minakata. What to me was very attractive is the fact that he clearly bases his understandings and his argumentation. He bases it both on contemporary Western science of the time, of course, and a deep understanding of Shingon doctrines and theology. It's not like some contemporary authors who are very popular today and write about animism. They read a simple book about Kukai, right? And they make up an entire argument based on nothing, because again, that's not exactly what Kukai said. But so it's a very superficial use of Japanese tradition. But in the case of Minakata, I mean, he had a deep understanding of that, and he was constantly exchanging his ideas with the learned Shingon monk, Doki Horyu, who's a very, very important figure in early phase of Japanese modernization. So he was in constant contact with Doki for many, many years. And they were writing like very long letters to each other, like entire chapters, basically, about doctrinal issues and all kinds of things. So this use, this deep knowledge about the Japanese intellectual tradition, Shingon in particular, and the deep knowledge of the new Western science combined in one figure, trying to create a different metaphysics, right? A different philosophy of reality, to me is deeply fascinating. And I think I kind of regret personally the fact that that attempt was not really pursued, because then in Japan they decided, you know, they cannot keep both of them together. So they decided to go only for the Western part of it.
Yeah, this is incredibly fascinating. Also, this modern, newfound interest in Japanese esoteric Buddhism, Mikkyo, right, and Shingon. And you also talked about something that is called the Minakata's mandala.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sort of a way to that people in Japan have been categorizing or summarizing his ideas and philosophies?
Yeah, well, Minakata, he wrote, see, in his letters to Doki and other people, he was including all kinds of scribbles and drawings. And there are two or three diagrams that he calls them mandala, but they're not Minakata mandala. Minakata mandala is something that was called, you know, by Nakamura Hajime, apparently, you know, the famous Buddhologist, when he was showed, you know, this diagram, say, oh, wow, this is Minakata. Minakata's mandala, but he was trying to represent in a diagram these incredibly complicated processes of life creation and transformation. So, for example, one of them includes basically the most famous one is a description of reality on the one hand and human attempts at understanding reality. So. He sees, Minakata sees reality as articulated on different levels. There are, you know, the most obvious one, the real one, the most direct one. And then there are some, like, more remote dimensions of reality, which he calls fushigi, you know, the more wondrous. And so the wonder of mind, because we don't really know how the mind works. So Minakata knows that it's there, but, you know, it can only be approximated very roughly. And then there is the wonder of principles. Again, we can make hypotheses about the principles of nature, but we don't really know what they are. So, you know, they're kind of further away in our epistemological field, right? Because we can know what is very close to us, but not what is very far away. And then the final one, you know, the final horizon of knowledge is the what he calls the Dainichi no Rai no Dai Fushigi, you know, the great wonder of the cosmic Buddha, Mahavairochana Dainichi. Which is really kind of a hypothetical framework that includes and encompasses all possible knowledge in the universe. So in that sense, he was making an argument. He was using this idea of Dainichi no Rai as the Dharmakaya, right, as the ultimate essence of reality, as the ultimate epistemological boundary or limit for humans to know. And to me, I mean, this is an interesting transposition. It's not completely wrong. I mean, in fact, it's quite accurate in terms of Shingon metaphysics, I think. But what is interesting is that, again, he's not quoting medieval authors. He's applying this Shingon metaphysics to contemporary epistemology and contemporary science.
This is really fascinating. He's certainly a very original and unique intellectual. And lastly, we've come to around 40 minutes. Can you maybe speak a little bit about the theoretical methods or approaches that are taken in the edited volume? You kind of mentioned that the volume takes an ontologically oriented approach about animism and highlights especially the agency of the intangible. Can you maybe elaborate on this a little bit and how they would contribute to our understanding of Japanese spirituality?
Well, yes. I would say maybe it would be more accurate to say that most authors actually, they have their own methodology. Some of them are more sociological, others are more like informed by literary criticism. But the anthropologists in them and some of the intellectual historians also are kind of following this new trend in anthropology, which is, you know, the ontologically oriented approach to animism, which tends to see invisible entities or immaterial entities as endowed on their own ontology. And the idea is that these entities cannot be just discounted as figments of imagination or superstitions or, you know, the fact that the natives don't really know Western science and therefore, you know, they come up with this kind of ludicrous descriptions of reality. Part of the interest of this new attempt is that, first of all, to some people, at least, these entities are real. So they have an ontological ground to them. Whether we agree with them or not is a different issue. But, you know, as an outsider, I cannot say that I know more than them, right? So I think I should take their ontologically grounded arguments about, you know, what these entities are and what they do. I should take it, you know, for what it is, right? Seriously, and try to make sense of it. This is one aspect. The other aspect is that a lot of these entities are experienced by people through the effects that they have. So there is a chapter that talks about, you know, how people feel, you know, in specific places that are haunted or, you know, they're believed to have spiritual presences in them. So the fact that they feel something in their body, I mean, that is a physical thing, you know, it's not just made up. I mean, a lot of these things can be fake, of course. You know, people can say that they feel something when they don't. But in many cases, I mean, there is something going on there. I honestly, personally, I don't believe in the existence of spirits, but I don't have the instruments to disprove it either, right, like most of us. So I think that the only sensible way to deal with these things is to take them seriously as the informants do, and try to make sense of the of this aspect of reality. So intangibles, spiritual entities, have agency because they are believed to do so, and these agencies, I think, need to be understood and described. And I think that this is something that is lacking in contemporary Japanese descriptions about animism, because people will tell you that, oh yeah, there are spirits and spirits do this and that. Or they say, oh yes, the Japanese are animists because they believe that, rocks can have a spirit. But they don't tell me what the spirit is or what it does, whether the spirit has a kind of a rational outlook or whether the spirit is completely rational and unfathomable and so forth. So, you know, I think we need this kind of theology of spirits to make more sense of what they are, you know, within the culture and how they operate. So I think that this is this approach to animism, which has been used by anthropologists for quite some time now, anthropologists mostly working on Africa and South America, where discourses about spirits are very important. So I think it's interesting that this tendency is now also expanding towards Japanese studies and the study of Japanese religions. So I would like to encourage, you know, this further collaboration. In fact, it's quite interesting, you know, when you read books about spirits, sometimes some of them are anthologies, right, of chapters dealing with spirits in different cultures. They never mention Japan, right? It's Africa, it's the Caribbean, it's South America. And in a way, Japan is the most important animistic country in the world. So it's kind of interesting that people are ignoring, anthropologists are ignoring it in many ways. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, but, you know, that's not really, when you think about animism, or this kind of ontological oriented animism, you don't think about Japan, you think about South America or, you know, the African religions in the Atlantic and so forth.
Great, thank you. And I urge our listeners to get a copy of the edited volume and get a closer look at these really refreshing perspectives. Well, Professor Rambelli, we've taken up a lot of your time, actually, and thank you so much for sharing your incredible research and all the contributors' research in the edited volume with us. Before we conclude our interview, could you maybe tell us about your current research projects? What have you been working on recently?
Oh, recently. I've been working on, it's a very different project from this one, although it is partly related to it. It's the cultural history of Japanese musical instrument. It's a very elusive instrument that is only used in the court, the music for the imperial court, and at Shinto shrines. And it's called the shō. It's a mouth organ. It's a very ancient instrument, still existing in Japan today. And what fascinates me about the instrument is not only the sound, of course, and the techniques involved in it, but it's the kind of the agency, the materiality of the instrument and the agency that it has, and the legends that were circulating about the, you know, kind of power that this instrument was supposed to have. So in a way, it is a continuation of my work on materiality and also, you know, my work on the spirits here, but it's more focused on one particular object, again, a musical instrument, which also opens, you know, the entire, you know, entire conversation about the materiality or immateriality of music, the philosophy of music, you know, the meaning of music and so forth. But maybe we can keep that for a future conversation.
Certainly. Well, that sounds like a great project. I think our listeners will be certainly looking forward to it. And finally, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed reading the book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me and for, you know, making me part of this very, very interesting conversation.